Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Today we're going deep on a case that's, well, it's a pretty big deal.
It really is.
Especially for corporate law. We're talking about Aronson v. Lewis.
Aronson. Definitely a landmark case. Every corporate law student, every lawyer, really.
Yeah. Everyone runs into it at some point.
For sure.
So just to kind of set the stage, what are shareholder derivative suits anyway? You know, what's the point of them? Why do they exist?
So think of it like this. You're a shareholder, right?
Okay.
And you think the company's directors are doing something wrong, like something that's going to hurt the company.
Mm-hmm.
A shareholder derivative suit is basically a way for you, as the shareholder, to sue for the company, you know, to make things right.
So you're kind of like stepping in like a...
Yeah, like taking the reins a little bit.
Taking the reins when the directors aren't doing their job. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So this Aronson v. Lewis case, that's all about demand futility, right?
Bingo.
That's a fun legal term, demand futility.
Mm-hmm.
But... what does that actually mean in plain English?
Okay, so usually before you can file one of these derivative suits, you have to go to the board of directors first. You have to ask them to take action.
Right.
What if the board is the problem? What if they're the ones doing the wrong thing or just ignoring it?
So it's like, hey, why would I even bother asking them? It's a waste of time.
Exactly. That's the whole idea behind demand futility. It's like saying, look, asking the board to fix this, that's pointless. They're either part of the problem or they're too chicken to do anything about it.
Makes sense. So you're basically saying, I'm skipping that step and going straight to court.
Yeah.
Bold move. Okay, so what exactly happened in Aronson? Give us the backstory. Who are the players? What went down?
All right, so picture this. It's 1984.
Big hair, leg warmers.
Exactly. And we're in Delaware.
Of course. The corporate law capital of the world.
Right. So the case goes up to the Delaware Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got Harry Lewis. He's a shareholder in Myers Parking System.
Okay.
And he's not happy about some of the deals going on between the company and one of its directors, a guy named Leo Fink.
Ooh, juicy. What kind of deals are we talking?
Well, there's Fink's employment agreement with the company. Then there's some consulting contracts. Oh, and he's also getting interest-free loans from Myers. The whole thing just seems a bit, you know.
Pepped cozy.
Yeah. Especially because Fink owned, like, 47% of the company's stock.
Whoa. So he's got a lot of sway. I can see why Lewis might raise an eyebrow or two.
Oh, yeah. Lewis basically argued that these deals, they only got approved because Fink had so much control over the board.
Like they were in his pocket.
Pretty much. And Lewis said these deals were just draining the company's resources, not in its best interest at all.
Classic corporate drama. So how does the whole demand futility thing fit in here?
Well, instead of going to the board first and saying, hey, investigate this, maybe sue Fink, Lewis went straight to court, filed that derivative lawsuit.
He just went for it, huh?
Yep. And his reasoning. He said making a demand on the board, that'd be totally useless because they were under Fink's thumb.
They wouldn't do anything about it, so he just bypassed them.
Yeah.
So he just went for it. Bypassed the board entirely. That's a gutsy move. Did it work? Did the court side with Lewis?
Well, not quite. You see, the Delaware Supreme Court, they're pretty strict about this whole demand futility thing.
Right. They're not just going to take your word for it.
Exactly. They said Lewis, he hadn't really given them enough evidence to back up his claim.
So it's not enough to just, like, say, oh, the directors are controlled by this guy. You need to actually prove it.
Exactly. You got to have the receipts. The court called it particularized facts, not just, you know, general accusations.
Particularized facts. So what kind of evidence would have convinced them? Like, what could Lewis have shown to really prove his case?
Okay, so imagine this. He could have shown voting agreements, right?
Like where the directors were obligated to vote the way Fink wanted.
Yeah, or maybe evidence that Fink was threatening them somehow, or that he had, like, financial ties to them that would, you know, influence their decisions.
So basically proof that they were either in his pocket or too scared to cross him.
Exactly. The court was like, look, just owning a lot of stock, that doesn't automatically mean you control the board. Even 47%, it's not enough on its own.
There has to be a direct link between the ownership and their actual decisions.
Right. And the court, they also weren't totally convinced by Lewis's argument that the deals themselves were, like, so bad.
So bad that they couldn't possibly be legitimate business decisions.
Yeah. They said, even if a deal turns out to be a bad idea, it doesn't automatically mean the directors were acting in bad faith.
Right, right. I mean, sometimes good people make bad calls.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean they're corrupt or anything.
Exactly. The court was basically saying, look, bad business decisions, they happen. It's part of the game. To prove demand futility, Lewis would have had to show that those deals were so outrageous, so far beyond the pale,
that no reasonable director could have possibly thought they were a good idea.
Right. Like, completely crazy, can't even explain it, kind of bad.
Okay, so the court set a pretty high bar there.
They did, and this is why Aronson is so important.
It really shaped how demand futility claims are viewed.
Big time. It made it clear that you can't just throw around accusations without solid evidence.
Gotcha. So they sided with the directors in this case.
They did.
But they also set some important ground rules for future cases.
Definitely. And to kind of formalize those rules, they came up with something called the Aronson test.
Ooh, the Aronson test. Sounds official.
It is. It's a two-pronged test, and it's become like the standard.
The standard for deciding if demand is futile.
Yep. Across the country, courts use this test. So you want to break it down and see what those two prongs are all about.
Absolutely. Lay it on me. What are the magic questions that determine a shareholder's fate?
All right. So the first prong, it asks, are the directors disinterested and independent?
Okay. So basically, are they making decisions based on what's best for the company?
Right. Or are they influenced by, you know, personal interests or relationships?
Conflicts of interest, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And the second prong, it focuses on the actual transaction that's being challenged.
So the deals that Lewis was complaining about in this case.
Exactly. And the question here is there reason to doubt that the transaction was a valid business judgment?
Even if it turned out to be a bad call in the end.
Yeah. Because remember, even smart people make mistakes. The court gets that.
So they're not trying to punish directors for honest mistakes, only if they were acting in bad faith or something.
Exactly. It all comes down to, did they do their due diligence? Did they act in good faith, even if the outcome wasn't great?
Okay, so under the Aronson test, you have to show either that the directors were compromised in some way.
Right.
Or that the decision itself was just so out there, so crazy, that no reasonable director could have thought it was a good idea.
You got it. That's the heart of the Aronson test.
Yeah.
And it's all about finding that balance.
Between protecting directors from frivolous lawsuits.
Right.
But also holding them accountable when they really mess up.
Exactly. A delicate balance for sure. And that's why Aronson is such a foundational case.
It set the stage for how we think about demand futility even today.
It did. But there's a twist.
Oh. A plot twist. Yes. I love a good plot twist.
Well, the legal world, it doesn't stay still for long. Things change. In 2021.
Okay, relatively recently.
Mm-hmm. The Delaware Supreme Court, they decided to shake things up a bit. They introduced a new test for demand futility, a universal one.
Whoa, a new test. So is the Aronson test, like, obsolete now? Are we throwing out the textbooks?
Not so fast. The relationship between the two tests is actually a bit more complicated than that. It's caused a lot of debate.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. Tell me more about this new test. How does it differ from Aronson?
Well, the Delaware Supreme Court, they recognize that things have changed a lot since 1984.
The corporate world is a whole different beast now.
Right. They wanted a test that was, you know, more flexible, more adaptable.
Makes sense. Yeah. So what's this new test all about?
It's a three-part test.
Yeah, a bit more complex than Aronson.
Yeah. And it takes inspiration from both Aronson and another important case, Rails v. Blass Band.
Okay, getting fancy now. So what are these three parts? What are the key questions it's asking?
All right, so the test asks, did a director at the time the lawsuit was filed? And then there are three parts.
Okay.
One, did they get a material personal benefit from the transaction?
So like, did they personally profit from whatever the shareholder is suing about?
Two, do they face a substantial likelihood of liability on any of the claims in the lawsuit?
So are they potentially in legal trouble because of what happened?
Mm-hmm. And three, are they independent from someone who did get a benefit or who does face liability?
Okay, so it's really digging into conflicts of interest, potential liability, and whether the directors were truly acting independently.
Exactly. It's all about making sure those directors are putting the company first.
Okay, I'm following you so far. But this new test, it's supposed to be universal, right? Meaning it applies to all demands utility cases.
That's the idea, yeah.
But you said it didn't completely replace Aronson, so now lawyers have two tests to deal with. How do they know which one to use?
Ugh, that's the million-dollar question. And it sparked a lot of debate. You see, when the court introduced the universal test, they didn't specifically say Aronson was gone.
So it's still out there, kind of lurking in the shadows.
Kind of, and that's created some confusion.
Makes sense. Two tests, no clear instructions on which one to use. Sounds like a recipe for a legal headache.
It can be. And that's why understanding demand futility today, it's not just about knowing the tests.
It's about knowing how courts are interpreting them, which one they're applying, all that.
Right. It's a lot more nuanced now.
Okay. So we've got a bit of a legal mystery on our hands.
We do.
Two tests, no clear hierarchy, lots of questions. But don't worry, everyone. We're going to unpack all of this in part three of our deep dive. We'll explore the arguments for and against keeping Aronson. We'll look at how courts are dealing with these competing tests.
We'll even get into some of the strategic considerations for lawyers and shareholders.
So buckle up, everyone. The demand futility saga continues. All right, everyone. Welcome back for the final round of our demand futility deep dive. We've covered a lot of ground, huh? Talked about the Aronson test, this new universal test. That's a lot to keep track of.
It really is. And, you know, like we were saying last time, having these two tests out there, it's kind of created some debate in the legal world.
Yeah, like, are they both still relevant? Is one better than the other? Should we just pick one and stick with it?
Right. Some people say we should ditch Aronson altogether, you know, just use the universal test, keep things simple.
Okay, I can see that. Less confusion. But what are the arguments for keeping Aronson around? Why do some people think it's still important?
Well, they say Aronson is still really useful in certain situations. Like when the board made the decision that's being challenged, you know, before the lawsuit was even filed.
Okay, so like those pre-suit decisions.
Exactly. And in those cases, they argue that Aronson's focus on director independence and whether the decision was a valid business judgment,
mm-hmm.
it's really important.
So it's like Aronson has its own special niche, you know? It's a tool that's still useful for specific jobs.
Right. And they worry that if we just get rid of Aronson completely, it could weaken the protections that directors have.
Through the business judgment rule, right?
Exactly. Because remember, the court doesn't want to second guess every business decision a director makes.
Right, they're not business experts.
Yeah, so there's that presumption that the directors, they're acting in good faith in the best interests of the company.
Makes sense. So it sounds like there are good arguments on both sides.
There really are.
Yeah.
And that's led to some inconsistency in how courts are applying these tests.
So different courts are doing different things.
Yeah. Some courts are still using Aronson, sometimes even by itself.
Wow. Like,
while others have gone all in on the universal test. So it's a bit of a mixed bag out there.
That must make it tricky for lawyers, huh? Trying to figure out which test to use, what arguments to make.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely made things more complicated. You really have to know the law in your specific jurisdiction.
And maybe even try to figure out how the judge in your case might lean.
Right. It's a lot more strategic now. Okay, so all of this legal back and forth, what does it mean for shareholders, the ones who actually want to bring these derivative lawsuits?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, these rules are supposed to protect shareholders, right? Give them a way to hold directors accountable.
Exactly. And this whole two-test situation, it really highlights how important it is to build a strong case for demand futility.
Like, you really got to do your homework.
You do. You have to be prepared to argue under both Aronson and the universal test.
So you're basically covering all your bases.
Right. You have to show why demand would be futile under Aronson.
By showing the directors were biased or conflicted or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And you also have to show why it would be futile under the universal test.
By proving those three parts, benefit, liability, lack of independence.
Yep. It's a lot more work now, but it's crucial.
Wow. Okay. So demand futility, it's a complex area of law, that's for sure.
It is. But even with all the twists and turns, all the debate,
it still serves an important purpose.
Oh, absolutely. It's all about finding that balance
between protecting directors.
Right.
And making sure shareholders have a voice.
Exactly. It's a constant balancing act. And the law is always evolving to try to get it right.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Thanks for walking us through all of this. I think everyone listening has learned a lot about demand futility, the Aronson test, the universal test, the whole shebang.
It's been a pleasure. And, you know, just remember, everyone, the law never stands still. It's always changing.
So stay curious, keep learning, and as always, thanks for listening.